So I am going to say something I never thought I would say. I miss Chekhov.
Really?
Yes, because Wesley is obviously the new Chekhov, and he is 10 times worse than Chekhov ever could be. I mean, at least all Chekhov did was be a little rapey. He didn't actively fuck everybody's shit up week after week.
That is true. Chekhov certainly was a professional member of Starfleet, in as much as anybody was a professional member of Starfleet at that time. And Wesley is...
an asshole!
He's a 15-year-old boy, so yes, he's an asshole.
I kind of thought that the twist at the end of Naked Now would be, but he doesn't have the intoxication, he's just 15! Like, are we going to be seeing Wesley's stupid inventions at week after week? Is that what the show is going to be?
I feel strange, but also good!
Yeah!
Yeah, this episode is really not great, and a large part of why it's not great is Wesley. I think it was a profound mistake to have Wesley be the driving part of the latter part of this episode, and it was also a mistake to warm over a plot from a show that had been off the air for 30 years, or 20 years at this point, and... it's not done very well.
And also, I would say it's a third mistake doing this as the second episode of the TV series, because one of the things that they need to do is to give this show a distinct identity. It's not Star Trek Phase 2. This is Star Trek The Next Generation. So having the same exact plot and... well, I mean, Naked Time was a little bit into Star Trek's run. It was still the first season episode, but... also, by that point, number one, the characters were a lot broader in the original Star Trek. They were a little more nuanced here. So, having these characters act drunk is not as much of a contrast as in the first episode. They were completely contradictory. You know, the original Star Trek characters might be a little more one note, but it's more obvious and more interesting when they're not hitting that note.
Well, I agree with you, and I think a couple problems with the Naked Now. Number one, like you said, it's just not a good idea to warm over a plot from the original series because the characters are not the same, and the knowledge that we're gaining of the characters is not the same. Now, the idea behind the Naked Now, of course, was to have an episode that would introduce character motivations in the same way that the Naked Time was used to sort of shortcut some of that and give us an idea of who these people were beyond the confines of a science fiction adventure plot, right? And The Naked Time is a great episode of the original series. It's, you know, not one of the best, but it's certainly good, and it does what it set out to do, which is let us know who these characters are and what they want. The problem I have with The Naked Now is, number one, it does come too early in the run, as you said, mm-hmm. because we were just introduced to these characters last week, and we don't really know anything about them. And number two...
Yeah, I can't tell what part is Picard has levity when he's with Dr. Crusher and what part is he's drunk. Like, I can't tell yet which part is his genuine motivation and which part is stuff that he's doing because he's professional, which he's not going to deny, like... that's pretty significant. Geordi's feelings about his sight, I don't know if those are something that he's just repressing or something that comes out of nowhere that he doesn't usually feel. Like, things like that. It's...
And the problem with this is that a lot of this stuff is never really brought up again.
Okay.
And because, you know, we'll talk about Code of Honor later, but one of the little things in Code of Honor was Picard's weird hissy fit about Data calling French an obscure language. And that kind of character beat was dropped almost entirely, you know, in the later part of the first season. And in a similar way, Geordi's thing about his vision never really comes up again. The on-again, off-again Beverly Picard thing that they were sort of setting up doesn't ever really go anywhere.
Interesting.
You know, there's a lot of character motivation in The Naked Now, which is almost entirely dropped later. So it feels superfluous in a way.
I mean, it almost seems like they were going to do what they were going to do with Captain Kirk and Yeoman Rand with Dr. Crusher and, you know,
a little bit, yeah.
And again, similarly, they dropped it after it turned out to kind of make no sense. Well, especially if, as you say, they make a point to not have conflict within the crew, then that makes sense because having a romantic plot is going to be conflict.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And it also just doesn't work. it doesn't work because it doesn't tell us anything about the characters in the in a similar way that Naked Time did, and that's kind of my problem with the Naked Now.
See, I don't, and it's so I could see if they wanted to do a similar plot, but they make these direct ties to the original series episode, and for about for a few minutes there, it seems like this is going to be solved immediately. Dr. Crusher has this vaccine that she's going to use. You know, they know pretty much about the disease, and then just because they realize there's an extra half hour of running time, the serum doesn't work. And then they have, again, Wesley doing his shit. I don't know. Part of me understands that this is a very different time, that Dr. Crusher is a lot less of a military person than, you know, Bones might have been, that she has a son to think of. But when I see the scene where Picard asks if she's tested the vaccine and she says no, I just think about how Bones would have already injected it in on himself if only Spock and Kirk hadn't been fighting each other for the privilege of doing it. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
There, you know, again, I understand why she is being a little more circumspect about this, but at the same time, I don't know. That just, it seems, it's less a criticism of her and more they're just stretching it out. This is a very stretched out plot.
No, I would agree with that. I mean, there's really only about 20 minutes of plot in this episode, and then they have to figure out how to extend it. And so, you know, we get Wesley taking over the ship or whatever the hell happened. And, you know, it's really funny to me because, again, well, I keep bringing up Code of Honor, but, you know, in that episode, Wesley is, you know, allowed to man the ops console for part of the episode. And it's like, a week ago, he almost caused the Enterprise to be destroyed. So why let him do any of this? And yes, I know he was under the influence of the water molecule or whatever, but it doesn't make any sense. And that's really my problem with it, is it doesn't make any sense. Why is Data affected by this?
Why is Data have a penis? He, like, that scene where he and Yar, like,
why wouldn't he have
I'm fully functional, that creeped me the hell out. I don't know. I
think it's supposed to. I don't know, but
what I think is interesting is, so in Naked Time you have
I want to get back to this though. Why do you think Data shouldn't have a penis? This is important information that our listeners want to know, and I want to know.
I'm just thinking about the guy who sculpted the penis for Data and what he thinks about his job.
You'll meet him later.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, because it's like, you can picture like a guy who's like, you know, Data's supposed to be the super advanced android.
Sure.
He is, you know, and so whatever scientists worked on him are probably so interested in the, you know, you go into robotics to work on AI and this mind and you're sculpting a dick. I don't know. It's
interesting you say that, because we will meet who made Data in a few episodes, actually.
Oh, good.
And let's revisit this question when we get there.
Okay.
That's all I'll say.
So, Naked Time, the scene that I remember stand out from that is when Spock gets infected and he's having his emotions and he, you know, that really creepy smile that anytime Spock smiles, it's creepy.
Sure.
And he and Nurse Chapel have one of their moments where, you know, she finally gets to make out with Spock, but it's under horrifying circumstances. And you see Spock as being very conflicted by this. Data goes right for it. Every time Data smiles, he's goofy. He just kind of figures, well, you know, Tasha Yar wants, you know, and I, okay, you know. I thought that was very interesting because that does make a... Now, in this case, I think the contrast between Data and Spock needs to be more clear. And in this instance, the way they react to this disease could not be more different. Again, Data wants to be human. He loves that part of himself. He loves, you know, whether he is simulating emotion or whether he's genuinely feeling it, that's a philosophical AI question that has been going on for...
He's not, but we'll get into that later.
I was going to say, I'm sure that a lot has been talked about that. You know, whether that's the case or not is almost irrelevant to him. He is feeling this.
Oh, it's very relevant, actually. I mean, this is the thing. This is the problem with talking about, you know, early episodes of any TV show. It's just that Data's emotions and the question around whether or not he has them becomes much clearer later. And the fact of the matter is Data doesn't have emotions. He's not capable of having emotions.
I almost got the sense in a way that he was kind of simulating having this virus because all of the other people were having this virus, and almost as a kind of power of suggestion, he began. I think he is performing drunk because all the other humans are performing drunk, and that's what a human does, and that's what he's going to do with
this. I think that that's probably not accurate.
Okay, so I don't understand.
I just don't see any evidence in the episode that Data was pretending to have it.
Well,
I think he really did, and I think they even went so far as to kind of give some sort of hand-wavy explanation where he said something about how his biomechanical processes are very similar to humans.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in that sense, does it make much sense that he would catch this virus? Not really, but all evidence in the episode points to the fact that he actually did. And so for me, it's just, yeah, that's the way things went.
Yeah, I guess. And I don't remember the exact nature of the virus in the original episode. They don't really figure it out or explain it too much here. So, you know, I guess I can accept that.
Well, that's the other problem I have with the episode where the actual, you know, the water molecule thing or whatever it is, it doesn't really get explained. They sort of give it a link to the Naked Time episode of the original series by having Riker remember somebody showering in their clothes, which I don't remember if that actually happened in the Naked Time.
I guess there was a similar incident.
I'm assuming that it did. And I actually like that because Riker doesn't get infected until much later in the episode. And what I like about that scene is that it's one of the stronger points in the episode that doesn't really get commented on, is that Riker remembers something kind of, you know, out of context and thinks it's related to what's going on.
Yeah.
And he turns out to be right, and it turns out to be the one piece of the puzzle that allows them to figure out what's going on and eventually cure it. And what I really like about that is it indicates that Riker is extremely smart. He has a good memory, and he has an instinct for knowing, you know, what to tell people and when to tell them and what will be relevant and not. And it makes him seem like a really competent officer.
Well, take it a step further because and go back to the conversation in the first episode where he's, you know, when he first meets Dr. Crusher and he, you know, she's saying like, look, you're making more work for yourself. You want to distinguish yourself. Like, he is ambitious and he's gotten onto the coolest ship in the galaxy, and he wants to be that awesome, be worthy of it. So certainly he remembers this because he's read about other ships with the name Enterprise in it.
Right.
So like he specifically, like that's an extremely arcane branch of thing. Like I want to distinguish myself, so I'm going to read about every ship that has the same name as this. Like, yeah, that's dedicated research.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
He probably can tell you everything about, you know, the engineering of, if he was beamed onto the original Enterprise, he'd be able to run that ship with no problem.
Yeah.
You know, like, so,
and I like that about Riker.
Yeah,
you know, I think
his thing is he wants all of the information.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in these early episodes, Riker comes across as probably one of the more likable characters.
Yeah. I mean, he's a good, competent officer. He's a little closer to old Star Trek characters.
Well, that's what I was about to say. He kind of almost makes me think of what Kirk would have been like when he was not a captain.
Yeah, exactly. Right? It's, he's going to grow up to be Captain Kirk in 10, 15 years. You know, he's just younger.
Yeah. And the thing about, you know, it's funny because, you know, I think that in this episode we see a lot of, you know, Picard doesn't come across as a very strong leader in this episode. You know, they don't really do any quarantine actions. They don't do anything really to stop this. And
they do, but they don't lock the sick bay door. Like, if they had locked Geordi in, that would have solved all of the issues, and
or order someone to beam Wesley out of engineering. I don't get why they couldn't just do,
you know,
that.
This chief engineer, I found it fascinating that the chief engineer is a woman, but she doesn't have a name. And let's compare her to Scotty. She says it'll take 2, maybe 3 hours. Like, she's realizing she needs more time than she originally would. She seems fine at her job, but she's not brilliant like Scotty was. I mean, there was an incident in the original series when someone's mimicking Captain Kirk's voice, and Scotty immediately realizes, you know, no, Kirk wouldn't say that. She and her assistant hear Wesley's little voice modulation machine and don't think, gee, why would the captain have the two people in charge of engineering leave engineering at the same time?
Like, right.
You would, Scotty would have picked up on that.
Yeah, they don't seem like they have, you know, much intuition, right?
Again, this is a newer crew, let's say. This is the first time this Enterprise has been in space a month, maybe.
Yeah.
So.
But I think that's interesting because I think it does set up, you know, this idea that this crew is largely untested and this crew doesn't really know how to work together yet. And they don't know each other very well.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's insignificant that the chief engineer is not a main character.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was very explicitly done to set the show apart from
certainly
the original series.
Does she recur? Like, is she...
We never see her again, I don't believe.
I didn't even know if there was a minor role like this.
The chief engineer role in the first season is sort of infamous because I think they have like four or five of them.
Well, let's put it this way. After this, do you think she or her assistant really have a job right now?
I mean, probably. I mean, that's the thing. We never see her again, but who knows why. And what I think is interesting about that is the fact that, I mean, let's talk about the Wesley problem. Because you talked about Wesley at the very beginning of the episode. I fundamentally do not understand why anybody would put up with him. And he's precocious. He's kind of an asshole. He's a 15-year-old boy, right? And yes, he's very smart and he can do all these things. And, you know, Geordi and he are friends or whatever. I don't know why Geordi went to visit him. It's fine. Maybe they're having some sort of illicit love affair. Let's just say that. And, you know, what I think is really...
He was drunk. Oh, my God. And he came to Wesley's... Oh, God.
And then he touched Wesley.
LeVar, no!
Yeah. I'm just saying.
Butterfly.
It's okay, though, because in the Federation, 15-year-old boys can give consent.
I don't want to know this.
They're very advanced. What I think is problematic about Wesley as a character is that everybody sort of indulges him. And I don't understand why anybody would indulge him, right? Because he almost destroyed the Enterprise indirectly. Yes, he was drunk and whatever, but it still would not... You don't let a 15-year-old wander around restricted areas of the most powerful starship in Starfleet. It just doesn't make any sense.
You think about again, this is a military base. Would they let, you know, just some kid hang out in the control room of the military base in the United States?
And I just remembered something else to your point about the engineer and the second, whatever, the second in command of
Mr. Jenga.
Right. Do you remember that when the chief engineer was called to the bridge by fake Picard, and then the second in command of engineering was called to sick bay by fake Picard, and Wesley shows up and he's like, "Nah, put me in charge." And the guy's like, "Yeah, okay, sure, that makes sense." And he leaves. Like, he was not affected by the virus, right? He had all of his mental faculties ostensibly there and working.
Turns out none of the engineering people were infected by the virus.
And so it's just cool with him to let a 15-year-old boy have control of the engineering section of the USS Enterprise.
You know what's happened behind the scenes that we haven't seen is that Wesley is in the engine room every fucking day. Like, he is bugging the chief engineer and the other engineer, and he's the guy who's reciting statistics and following them around as they're doing their job. That's probably how he and Geordi became friendly. You know, they both seem to enjoy gadgets and tinkering, and, you know, Geordi is legitimately impressed that Wesley has made this tractor beam. I mean, maybe he's even taught Wesley part of how that, you know. So, I mean, they get used to the idea of just this kid's around, and I guess he, you know, the engineer figures, all right, well, I'll be 5 minutes in sick bay, you know, and nothing's going to happen in the next 5 minutes. But at the same time, they're in a situation where they need to be ready to leave at any moment.
And
the sun is about to go nova. You know, Worf has said, like, you know, we have plenty of time. Who was it that said we have plenty of time?
I don't remember, but yeah.
Even at half impulse, we can get out of this. Like, this is not a problem. But that said,
put one of the, like, 10 ensigns that are wandering around in charge more than the 15-year-old kid.
Like,
that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I was going to say, the assistant doesn't have an assistant. Like, you know, he doesn't have a guy under him who can take the helm. Like, that's what, you know, that's why you have... I also wonder about the idea of what does it say that you can have a 15-year-old kid who has not been through Starfleet Academy to take a ship position? Like, what does that say about Starfleet training that it's so you can learn it on your own?
Well, I think the implication there is more that Wesley is some sort of, like, incomparable genius, which is something that we will get to later.
I was
going to
say, but that's not the case because he's dumb.
No, it really is the case. It really is the case that he is supposed to be, like, some sort of, like, savant-level genius. I am not kidding you.
No, I could see where they would go with it. I'm just saying if it is, he's an idiot savant.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a point that I want to make is that what I thought interesting about the episode is that you have Dr. Crusher and Picard, and they are completely in the throes of this, but they are also getting it together.
Yeah.
And I think that's very interesting that they, you know, they need each other to kind of remind each other, you know, she has the vaccine and she's like, I don't remember where I was going. And he's like, oh, maybe it has to do with that, you know, but they are professional enough that they are completely aware of what's happening to them and they are fighting it. And I think it's at the end, you see the crew is starting to learn to be, we've had the phrase Starfleet material, you know, and especially in the first, I think this is, they do start to learn to be Starfleet material at the end because, you know, again, they're all just fighting against it, but they do their shit. They do what needs to be done.
And I will say, I don't disagree with you, but I will say that it is a problem that you think that because these are supposed to be people at the top of their career that have been in Starfleet for years.
Well, yeah. Okay. And that's a fair point.
Like, I don't disagree with you again, but I think that that's a problem with the show as it's set up in the first season, especially.
I guess it made, yeah. Cause I'm thinking like, all right, well, it makes sense that Crusher and Picard would be, you know, the most in control of themselves. They're the oldest. They seem to have the most experience under them, but you're right at this point, you know, Data should be able to get in control of himself.
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to talk about the other characters for a minute.
Yes.
Because I think one of the main problems with this episode in general, I feel, is that the character motivations as they come across are not edifying in the same way that they are in The Naked Time. They're just weird, right? And Yar is problematic. Mm. And sexist. I think that...
Do they ever figure out what to do with Tasha Yar? Because...
I'm not going to answer that. I think that, you know, and maybe that's an answer. I think Tasha Yar, they said, oh, well, look, we have a woman as, you know, security chief. That's great. You know, that's very progressive. So in the second episode of our show, let's have her get drunk. And her deepest desire is to be pretty.
Yeah,
that's like, just that's a problem. I mean, that is just sexism to a T right there. And it's like, it completely, you could have given her so many other motivations. She's got that bizarre line about, like, escaping rape gangs.
See, like, on the one hand, it does almost make sense because she grew up on this colony world that was an absolute shithole, and it would make sense that she never really had the opportunity to, you know, hang out and, you know, wear a cool outfit and just, you know, enjoy. Men for her were not, you know, somebody that she could hang out and have a relaxed good time with. I get that, you know, and that's fine. And it does make sense that to a degree, when she has no inhibition, she wants to just be able to sit back and relax and not have to worry about anything. And that's fine. I can see her as a person who gets into security because she is constantly paranoid. Like, that makes sense. That said, I don't know if it makes, they set up a dichotomy where she is the sexless security chief or she's this, you know, wearing these hot dresses. When you have, I mean, in this very episode, the way that she is, talking to, you know, Troy, and she's saying, you know, you wear such nice clothes outside of, like, it's clear that Troy has figured out how to keep her personality as a woman at work and in her private life, as has Dr. Crusher. Troy and Crusher are not defeminized in any way. And I can
Okay. So I don't want to interrupt you, but I think there's a couple things there. Number one is that Troy is not a good example because Troy is walking around in a fucking cat suit.
Well, there's that.
And she's got ridiculous hair. Dr. Crusher has no sex life to speak of. She's very dowdy. You know, I don't think she comes across as extremely feminine. I don't think she comes across as a character that is, that knows how to use her femininity in any way.
You know what she becomes later, so that's a fair point.
That's true. But my problem with the way they set Tasha Yar's character up in this episode is that, yes, she is the sexless security chief. She has, you know, the practical short hair.
Yeah.
She's, you know, I'm like the woman and blah, you know. And at the same time, as soon as she becomes, uninhibited, she wants to wear pretty dresses and she puts her hair in a different way and she's wearing a lot of makeup. And it's like, what I find sexist about that is the idea that a woman cannot be both of those things at the same time. And I think one of the ways that women get empowered and become liberated is to be able to integrate those two things and say, no, it is not. Because what I think the episode is saying is that she can either be an effective security chief, she can either be powerful and she can basically be a man, right? Or she can be a sex pot. Well, and I don't agree with that. And I think that there is a way for her to, I think there's a way for women in general to integrate those two parts of themselves into a coherent whole. And I think it's a problem that the episode doesn't think that.
Well, let's go back to the season 3 episode of the original series with the Romulan commander, who very much is a strong military leader, very much is feminine. You know, she recognizes that at certain times it's appropriate to be more one than the other, but I don't get the sense that those are two distinct personalities. They're just aspects of her that she, you know, again, naturally shifts depending on the situation. That was a very well integrated, that the more I think about that character, the more I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
This implies that, again, she's either one or the other, and she's made her choice and she regrets not being able to be the other.
I'll sum it up in a different way. If you're reaching back to the original series as an example of how it's doing feminism right, then we have a problem with our show that's set in that's, you know, made 20 years later.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we've pretty much covered that episode.
I feel like we talked about this a lot more than I expected to.
What do you want to give this one?
3 shots of immunization.
Now, I think we need to have a new thing for the next
generation.
Yeah,
I don't know what we're going to do.
That's okay. We'll just give it a 3 for now. We'll come up with something. Something will happen and you'll be like, yes, that's it.
Okay. 3 Neo Tribbles.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's a 3, maybe a 4, but that's about it.
Okay.
All right, well, let's move on to our second episode this week, Code of Honor.
More like Code of Crap. No, I see why.
Yeah.
This is an original series episode. I am surprised that it was not. I would be surprised if it were not an old script that had been lying around that they dusted off and changed a couple characters.
Oh, it's not.
Because
it was written for the show.
Well, it's an original series episode in every way. I see exactly what you mean by saying, like, the series hadn't found its own voice yet. It's trying to be an old series. It feels very dated in the way the plot is paced.
Yes, it feels very dated in the way the plot is paced. It feels very much like the type of story that the original series was interested in telling. It doesn't have a lot to do with the characters. It doesn't have a lot to do with character motivation or telling us about the future. And I mean, I don't think there's any way to dance around it. This episode is racist. Like it's not a good episode. Like full stop. I think it's offensive.
I was going to say, again, this is an alien culture. You give a variety of skin tones to the alien people. Fine.
Yeah. Why did they cast every single alien as a black person. Like, that is what is so galling about this. I mean, you avoid this entirely if you cast, like you said, a variety of races in these roles.
I don't even have a problem with the actors that they picked as the main aliens. Because what? They'd all do great job. The wife, especially. I actually really liked her in this. You know, I like the main, whatever, chief guy, the king dude. But yeah, this is a redo of the Ponfar episode, but shitty.
The end of it certainly is.
And I just think about the framing of the Ponfar episode where it's this open arena and it's the music is wonderful. It was very difficult to parse visually what was going on because you have all of these lines going on and covering half of covering the actresses and the shot is from far away. And it was very awfully directed.
Well, certainly it is. But I mean, I don't want to drop the racism angle here.
No, I'm certainly.
Because, you know,
there are so many problems with this episode. I
think really this is a terrible episode because they lean into, they don't avoid the sort of like African savage trope. I mean, this is something that probably was straight out of like a 1940s, you know, Universal serial. Like, it's really bad.
Yeah.
You've got basically an alien culture that is just a bunch of African savages. You know, and I don't mean that to be like there are African savages. I mean, like, this is like, you know, this is almost like bone in the nose. Like,
this is kind Heart of like, Darkness.
This is
coupled
really
with
bad.
The Mongols, because he does say, you know, you remind us of an Earth culture. This is from China. Remember that part?
I don't know if that was supposed to indicate that they thought that they were Chinese or whatever, but like, you know, just the idea that
it was deflection. If they, you know, he should have given them like an African mask and been like, booga booga, we're racist. It's just be open about it.
It's like they feel like there's this alien culture feels like they're civilized, much more civilized than the Federation culture, certainly. Picard is doing everything but walking around and winking when he says that, because, you know, he talks about the Prime Directive, and we'll get into that because this is the introduction to the Prime Directive in the Next Generation. What a terrible introduction it is. And it's just kind of it's so galling that they went this way with this. I mean, we've got characters who are fighting to the death for no reason. We've got characters who basically are saying, look, women are only good for one thing, which is owning land, and then we fuck them, and then we get their land and their power. We have just you know, the most galling stereotypes, really, with African Americans and black people in general. You know, it's the costuming just comes across as bizarre. Like, the way that the episode is structured, the whole, like, I mean, the leader, the black man, kidnaps a white woman. I can't even, you know, believe.
And it's considered a brave act in their culture, number one. Like,
I don't know what anybody was thinking when they made this episode. I find it almost incomprehensible.
No,
that they thought that this was going to read as anything but extremely racist.
Yeah, it's racist. It's sexist. Again, should we talk about Tasha Yar? Because
We should talk about Tasha Yar. We should talk about Tasha Yar as much as is appropriate, because Tasha Yar is going to be gone eventually. So let's talk about her while she's here.
See, like, I don't know. There's on the one hand, I think it's interesting the initial stages of the episode when she and What is he? Is he a king? Is he a chief? Is he the mayor?
You're asking me? I don't know.
The Grand Poobah is, you know, and she there.
We watched the same episode, dude. Yeah. I don't know.
I think their interactions in the initial stages are very interesting because, you know, here he is. He's surprised by the idea of a strong warrior woman, but definitely impressed by her. They do have a chemistry together. Again, you know, she does admit even later in the episode, you know, she finds him attractive. He is very, you know, at the beginning, he is very charming. He's a king, you know, who's gonna you know, of course, you know, when the wife says, you know, how could you not be attracted to him? That's not an out of nowhere thing. You know, it's makes sense that, you know, someone would be. But then again, once he gets to the
I don't know. I think if somebody kidnaps
me, I gonna say once he gets to the kidnappy stage, then the episode just becomes, frankly, so much less interesting. I think it's more interesting if you have an episode about, you know, you're genuinely conflicted. Like, let's say you do have this culture that is, let's take all the kidnap rapey and let's make him out of, you know, let's get it so he doesn't have this evil plan to get his wife's lands. Well, what if this is about the conflict between...
Let's be clear. There's no implication in the episode that he rapes Tasha Yar.
There's no implication
in the episode that he harms her in any way. And in fact, I think the episode goes out of its way to portray Tasha Yar as someone who, while not in control of the situation, is able to take care of herself. Because if you remember that scene where Picard finally beams down to the planet and wants to see Tasha Yar, and finally he gets, you know, pissed off and says, yes, bring her, and he claps. Wow. That Tasha Yar comes out with a guard, and the guard has a black eye. So,
oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah. So, well, that's the thing.
Is that an HD thing?
It's probably an HD thing. You probably can't make it out in the SD version, but that's, I think that that's a strong inclination that Tasha Yar, I think this episode, much more than Naked Now, shows Tasha Yar as someone who has integrated those two parts of her personality better.
And let's face it,
the Naked Now allowed her to learn how to do that a little bit. Maybe I'm reaching.
I mean, she does, you know, especially to Troy, you know, they do say that they're friends, you know, so maybe, yeah, even after the Naked Now, I'm sure Troy took her shopping, you know, like, look, you know, you were drunk, but we're going to go out and we're going to have a day. You know, I'm sure that happened. And also, let's face it, the King has seen what Yar can do in combat. She saw her effortlessly, you know, beat this judo guy while, you know, his second in command, whose battle prowess he knows very well, you know, was immediately defeated. So I guess he knows not to fuck with her too much.
And I think that, you know, he sees her fighting in the holodeck and realizes that this may be his way out, right?
Yeah.
You know, again, it is very similar to Amok Time in that it is a bunch of machinations by someone. And I think it is interesting that, you know, what is Lutan's plan, right? Let's go through this. Lutan obviously is in a marriage, you know, people, men on this planet marry women own the land and the men take care of it. So if a man is not married to a woman who has land, then he is nothing, right? He doesn't have power. He doesn't have wealth. He has nothing. So, and there's that interesting exchange between Picard, Lutan, and his second.
Yeah.
When the second lets slip that Lutan isn't actually wealthy, because it seems that in this culture, that men, while they take care of and steward the land and the wealth for their women, don't actually own the wealth in the land, right? So that's a problem. And I think what his plan is he sees Tasha Yar as a solution to a problem, which is, I want my wife out of the picture. If she dies, I inherit her land. And I think it's interesting that in this culture, apparently the only way for a man to own land is to have his wife die while he's married to her as a first husband. Obviously, his plan seems to be Tasha Yar is really capable. Tasha Yar is very powerful. He sees Tasha flip over his guy in the very beginning of the episode before even the credits. He sees her fighting in the holodeck. She seems very strong.
Well, let me put it, so, I mean, even further.
She's going to kill his wife, and then she's going, assumedly, she is going to say, turn down his offer of marriage, and then he's going to be happy and in charge. That seems to be his plan. It doesn't work out that way, because the Federation sort of does some weird things, but as plans go, I think it's fine.
It's similar enough to the Amok Time plan, actually, where, she, you know, most likely, you know, Yar will, again, even if women just do inherit the land as his new first one, Yar would inherit, and she would want to go back on the starship anyway. Which is just like, you know, Spock's wife when she chooses Kirk. You know, he's not going to be around to, you know, they say to, you know, the King, you know, you have nothing to lose. And it is true. You know, if Yar gets killed, well, he's in the same exact situation he was. And you know, he'll figure out another plan to kill his wife. Why it takes her this long to click to that is surprising.
Especially since, you know, Luton's wife seems wily and intelligent and with
it.
And I think she realizes what her husband is doing. I don't know why she doesn't necessarily realize, you know, in the moment why he's doing it. And they do kind of justify it a little bit by saying that this is something that hasn't happened in, you know, hundreds of years or whatever they say. You know, but at the same time, you kind of have to at least expect that.
Yeah, I get the sense that she could, you know, when she has the conversation with Tasha and she is saying, you know, how could you not love him? You know, you do get the sense that his wife does, you know, have a strong attraction and affection for him. Maybe she just is blinded by that. And maybe she, you know, gets this moment of jealousy seeing, you know, Tasha. And maybe that conversation does really make it begin to plant the seed that, no, something else is happening. You know, she's kind of inertia going with this because, you know, but it isn't until, again, the legal trickery they do at the end, whatever.
Well, I think it's interesting in that it is very similar to Amok Time.
Yeah, it's the same basic plan. They fake someone's death.
Only it's reversed, of course, because they're not faking Tasha Yar's death.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's almost kind of mean because I think that this episode kind of contradicts the point that humans have grown out of jealousy and malice and revenge because the act of having Tasha Yar kill Luton's wife and then bring her back to life, thus negating his ownership of her land and property and making him powerless and making him a second husband and making the other guy the first husband, seems like the act of someone who doesn't like Lutan and wants him to suffer.
Yeah. At the same time,
why do that?
I don't know. They're using the rules of the society against it. You know, we'll talk about Prime Directive, I guess, in a second. But Picard's goal is how do we satisfy the code of honor, which is the code of this society, and the Prime Directive at the same time. And, I mean, the plan does do that. But I guess where I thought it was going to go, I thought that they didn't seem to really discuss all of this with the wife beforehand. Like, she just woke up and say, you know, and then Crusher saying, you know, okay, you died, but you're back to life now. Here's Picard going to tell you what we're going to do. You know, I almost got the sense that they had faked her death. You know, they were going to say, oh, we faked the death. You know, she was going into this as a big show.
Yeah, what was their plan if Tasha Yar had lost the fight?
I guess to beam her up as well and revive her then.
Yeah, but that wouldn't have saved them. I mean, that wouldn't have solved their other problem.
No, but he does say at one point, you know, get ready to beam, you know, Tasha out of there if things go completely, you know, wrong. And
well, that implies that the right part of the plan was for the wife to die. And so that's where you get back to my point that Picard wanted some sort of revenge on Luton for messing his shit up.
I mean, I don't know what you want from me. It's not a good episode.
No, I know. Yeah. I seriously think,
but,
though,
you know, that you're right. That I guess this is one of the reasons that it's not a good episode, because it's not thought that well out.
Yeah, no, it isn't well thought out. I mean, that's clear. You know, and even the whole idea that this planet would have a vaccine for a disease that the Federation can't cure. I mean, that doesn't really make any sense either.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of like the MacGuffin of the episode.
That's an original series MacGuffin.
They need some reason to be there. And so they're there. I mean, if they didn't need the vaccine to save millions of people on that planet, then they would have left and that would have been the end of it. So let's talk about the Prime Directive then.
So the Prime Directive seems to be that, I mean, there's a part where Picard says something like, you know, yeah, we have a starship. Why can't we just, you know, take what we want, you know? And he seems to be not completely tempted, but he does, you know, recognize that it is only, you know, that they have their own code of honor, which prevents them from, you know, because when you talk about bigger sticks, you know, the Federation has the biggest stick of all in this scenario. So, yeah, he...
Well, there's that bizarre scene when Luton first kidnaps Yar and he launches like 10 photon torpedoes at the planet in some sort of in some sort of like male penis display, which is weird. Like that doesn't seem like something that a Federation starship would do. I don't know what he's really thinking he's going to accomplish there, because of course he's been briefed on the planet's culture and he knows that that's not going to get them anywhere.
And
so,
then Troy has to tell him like that's not really going to work with them. Like I will want to talk about Troy in this episode.
Especially since Troy doesn't really have much of a presence in either of the episodes this week, but the presence that she does have is interesting.
But we
can talk about Troy in a minute. I think there's a couple things about the Prime Directive in this episode, and especially in the way it's introduced and portrayed. I think, number one, you're right. It is set up as a counterpoint. This is the Federation's code of honor as opposed to the Ligonian's code of honor, right? And we are ostensibly supposed to identify and agree with Starfleet's code of honor more than the Ligonian's code of honor. That's number one. I think the other thing that's interesting about it is this is an episode that is very much designed in a way to set up the idea of the Prime Directive and introduce it to the audience who may not be familiar with it. And that's kind of the meta level of it, but I think it's an important part of it because, of course, this was a show that was linked to the original series in a way. And we've seen that in the last episode, and we see that in this episode because, of course, the Prime Directive is not something that the Next Generation writers came up with.
Yeah.
This was something that was in the original series. And so it was kind of a way to link the two shows together, but also allow the show to develop its own identity, because I think that the idea of the Prime Directive in The Next Generation is something that is much further than what it was in the original series.
The original
and
series,
I don't think that I don't think that the Prime Directive would have stopped Kirk from just taking Tasha Yar back. I mean, if this had been an original series episode, in a lot of ways it is, but I think in a lot of ways it isn't, because Picard is someone who very much feels that his hands are tied with the Prime Directive. He knows that he can't go against it, and he knows that interfering in the internal matters of this culture, no matter what it is, no matter even if they kidnap a member of his crew, is a line that he cannot cross.
Usually Kirk plays along for a little bit, which is partially, you know, he doesn't want to escalate if he doesn't have to, you know, maybe they'll give up. He also is doing it partially, he always does it as reconnaissance to figure out exactly what they're capable of. But yeah, usually around the halfway point of the episode, you know, Kirk throws up his hands and says, all right, we're going to, you know, we're going to actually do some action now. And then he, you know, Picard never really gets to that point. He's not a very active captain in this episode.
No, I think that's true. And I mean, if you think back to something like the episode A Taste of Armageddon, where Kirk destroys the computer, which is waging war on these two, you know, against these two planets, you know, Picard would not have done that. I don't know what Picard would have done, but you get the sense that Picard is a much more deliberative captain, and he's one that is not going to take action unless he knows exactly what is going to happen. This is not a captain who likes ambiguity.
Yeah. Now, I think that, I mean, it's possible that the Prime Directive within the Federation has evolved over the generations. Because here it's, you know, in the original series, it seems more like don't fuck with the society just because. But here's some exceptions when you can fuck with the society, and they're all called Kirk's Clauses. But within here, it almost seems like you got to kind of handicap yourself. You know, they have, you know, it seems more like a play fair type of rule, because either way, you know, that they need to, you know, accomplish their goal of getting the vaccine while still getting Tasha back, and while still, you know, letting Lutan know that, you know, what you're doing is wrong. Like, those are the goals in this episode. That is fucking with a society. It just dictates the choice of weapons, really.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think the other problematic part of the episode is, you know, if the Prime Directive does not allow them to interfere in a culture, why does it allow them to trade with them? And, you know, obviously, you know, there's that line about the Ligonians do not have as advanced technology as the Federation, but, you know, they have transporters, at least. We see that. I mean, you know, and so we don't know the level of technology that they have, but it's implied that they are allowed on the starship. They're allowed to see what technology the Federation has.
You get the sense that the Federation has more of a presence around here. Like, this is not the first they're hearing of the Federation. They've probably had yeah. the first contact already. They knew who Federation officers are.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the Ligonians know all of that. And this is not supposed to be the first contact. You know, it's just one of those things where it seems to... The Prime Directive in this episode seems more a function of the plot than anything yeah. else. And it seems like a way for the plot to be driven forward.
It's the Wesley of this episode.
A little bit, yeah.
The one thing is, I like Troy a lot in this episode. I don't think they've 100% figured out how to write her yet. And again, from what I'm told, they never completely do. But part of it has to do with her role in this episode. Now, they have Picard beaming down, and it's very interesting that he essentially asks Riker for permission. Like, I think that's very interesting that they, you know, they've made that, you know, Riker's job is to make sure that, you know, there's a check on the captain in a way, and it's Riker. I don't know. Now, part of it implies that that's how Picard wants it, because he does want somebody, you know, making sure he's not, you know, making a stupid decision. But
Well, think back to that scene in Encounter at Farpoint in the observation lounge when Riker and Picard first meet and Picard grills him on that very point.
Yeah.
And that is the moment when Picard, when Riker doesn't back down, you know, that's the moment that Picard says, okay, this is someone that I can trust.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to show a little bit of vulnerability to Riker.
Yeah. Again, I think he likes having just somebody who he likes his second to command to be the one who, you know, tells him if it's okay or not. Because again, as the captain, he has to show a braver front. As the captain, he has to, you know, as a captain, he may be not as, you know, in control of his own abilities. You know, he may not be as aware. You know, Riker's the one who's going to say, no, you have an alien virus in you. You're not going out today. You know?
Right, right.
Troy is always at his side, and I noticed that she's at his left hand on the bridge. Like, she's very close to him. She kind of has the Spock role in this episode, and in a way, she is kind of a Spock of emotions. Like, Beta, you know, Spock is always able to tell you what the logical response to anything is. He's able to look at a situation and dispassionately say, well, the logical thing to do is this. She's able to look at a situation and figure out immediately what the social or emotional proper response is. She is kind of the opposite, but I also think it's very interesting that she makes the point of saying that, you know, we're also very practical. At one point she gives, I don't remember the exact advice she gives, but, you know, Picard shows surprise, you know, that, you know, it's a very cold thing. I think when she says, you know, you need to, you know, Yar needs to fight this, you know.
Yeah.
You know, yes, I'm not happy about that, but at this point, like, something transcends emotions. I think that it's interesting that she, unlike Spock, starts off knowing the limits of her abilities.
That's interesting, and that's not something I'd considered before.
I mean, she is half Betazoid as well. She's not a full Betazoid. She is... Yeah. Just as Spock is half and half.
I think that there's something to that. And I think a lot of what that indicates is more the time period the show was made in. Because if you look at the 80s in general and the late 80s, I mean, this was the age of self-esteem. This was the age of, you know, emotion and let's all get together and kumbaya. So in a lot of ways, I think, you know, and you even see that in the way that the ship is constructed with the carpets and the soft woods and things like that. And so I do think that's something that the show grapples with, and Troy as a character in general becomes problematic and you know, whether or not they figure her character out ever is up for debate. And we'll certainly discuss that over, you know, the time that we talk about the Next Generation. But I think in this episode, at least, she does make a strong case for her being there.
Yeah,
because she is an advisor. She is someone who, while she doesn't have all of the information, she's able to appropriately take the information that she is getting that other people don't have. Because let's not forget, if you compare her to Spock, Spock very much was synthesizing information in a similar way to Troy, but using different tools and getting to a different place.
Well, put it this way:
both are correct.
At this point in the beginning of the episode, when he's giving the sample of that vaccine, you know, Yar physically grabs it, knocks the guy down, and, you know, says, no, it's my captain. I'm the one who has to look at this, you know, to see if it's trapped, you know. And Troy is the one who says, you know, we shouldn't, you know, apologize because culturally, if we apologize, it's going to mean this. And, you know, if we don't apologize, they, you know, they're going to understand why. You know, that's a very, that's something that she's using her powers and her insight to determine. And that's a very important thing. Obviously, it doesn't go that well in the end, but you know.
I also think there's an implication there that Troy has done some homework.
Oh yeah, and that's her job. She is to know everything about these people.
Yeah,
she is.
She's there.
Yeah.
To make sure that things don't go badly.
No,
I think is her ultimate job.
She's kind of a mediator in a lot of ways, certainly. And you know, Spock might have been able to say. Spock probably would have said, you know, Captain, don't apologize because you know. These people are a warrior people and they would see, you know, they will respect Tasha for, you know, like,
right.
He would know the logically, you know, what that would mean. They would come to the same conclusion, but probably going, you know, again, it's interesting how they're going about it on other things and the fact that he values her, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's Code of Honor.
Okay. Well, it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be.
One.
Two, because I liked Troy in it.
Okay. It's a rough ride early on. The show gets rougher next week.
Do they figure out what to do with Worf? Because he hasn't done anything yet.
They do, yeah.
Oh, good.
I mean, you have to remember that Worf was only a recurring character at this point.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So I think he was in like 13 episodes this season.
Okay, yeah, because so, he hasn't done anything.
Yeah, like, he wasn't a main character at this point. He steps up after Tasha Yar leaves the show.
Okay, yeah, he's kind of like... Not even Sulu, but the guy who's fucking Sulu that week.
Yeah, he definitely does get a lot more to do.
Okay.
Well, next week, we will talk about The Last Outpost and Where No One Has Gone Before.
Oh, God, is that a sequel?
We'll see you then.